We are in the book of Esther. The last 2 weeks, we've been looking at the providence of God, the subject that basically tells us that God is involved in our lives all the time, that he's bringing his eternal plans into the realm of time. And what we're going to do this evening may, in a sense, feel like we're back in elementary Sunday school. We're going to go back and relive those days to some degree, but I think it will be very valuable for us. I'm actually just going to tell the story of Esther. And as I tell the story of Esther, along the way, I'm just going to pause us just to take note of some things, just to emphasize some things. We'll go all the way through the story, and I'll try to bring it together, and I think it will actually be very helpful to us. Oftentimes in life, and as we're studying God's Word, it's helpful to look at the forest before we look at the trees. And we could start looking at all the trees, but I think if we look at the forest first, we'll have the big picture. And I think it will help us very much, in particular, as we study the book of Esther. Everyone loves a good story. I love a good story. I think most people do. And the book of Esther contains all of the elements that make an excellent story. It has plot that develops and develops and develops. You have suspense, and you have rising action until you get to the point of very intense tension. And then you have crisis and resolution. You have good and evil. You have reversal, a drastic reversal where the tables get totally turned. You even have romance, if that's a big deal to you in a story. Loyalty and betrayal. And best of all about this story, I mean, we use the word story, but this is true. This is history. It's actually happened. And so we're going to start, and we're just going to tell the story. And we begin in chapter 1. And the story begins with the king of Persia. He's the greatest man on the earth at the time, and he's got a huge name to go with his big title. His name is Ahasuerus. I'll probably slaughter that name if I say it too many times, but he's otherwise known as Xerxes. So that's what we're going to call him. We're going to call him Xerxes. And he reigned from 486 to 465 BC over the Persian Empire. Chapter 1, verse 1 tells us that his empire was vast, that it consisted of some 127 provinces. This guy's big time. He's big stuff. And in the third year of his reign, just to remind everybody how big he is, how important he is, and that he truly is the boss, so to speak, he throws a 180-day feast for his nobles and princes. And in that time, he's showing off his wealth, the splendor of his kingdom, and his glory. And through that all, he's reminding everybody who's in charge. Many historians also think that this feast was more than just a feast. It had a lot of political things going on. Most historians believe that he used this 180 days as preparation time for his upcoming invasion of Greece, which is, if you study history, Xerxes, it does not go well for him. And it probably happens, his invasion of Greece probably happens between chapter 1 and chapter 2. He's horribly defeated. But at the end of this 180-day feast, he throws another 7-day feast for all the people, great and small, the people of Shushan. What better way to end a 180-day feast than with another 7 days of feasting? I mean, we think we do it big when we have Thanksgiving and you have all these courses. I mean, these people are feasting big time. But the thing about this feast is that it was really, in many ways, one giant drinking party. And as we'll see this as we get into chapter 1 and the weeks ahead, but the king basically tells his servants, give these people whatever they want to keep them happy. And see, the alcohol is just coming. And on the 7th day of the feast, the last day, the king and all of his buddies are no doubt extremely intoxicated, and the king summons Miss Persia. Miss Persia, Queen Vashti, to come before him and to parade around before him and all of his drunken buddies as his trophy wife. And she refuses. She's going to have nothing to do with this. The text doesn't tell us why. It doesn't tell us if she's just a woman of morals. It just makes sense. Who would want to do that? She's not going to do this. And she's not going to be coerced into what her drunken husband has asked her to do. And the king's blood is boiling. But it's not just boiling, it's bubbling with alcohol. He is not a happy camper. So he asks his wise men what he should do to Queen Vashti. And the wise men decide that in order to keep all the other women of the kingdom, if we might say, in line, I mean, he's just thrown this huge feast. It's a public occasion. And the queen has just stood up the king. All the other women of the kingdom are going to get this idea that that's acceptable behavior. And so now the king's wise men say, all right, this is not good. In order to keep all the other women of the kingdom in line, the king should make an example of Vashti, replace her with someone better. And so he says, okay, that's exactly what I'll do. Out with Vashti, I'm going to get myself a new queen. And shortly thereafter, the king probably disappeared for 2 years to attempt his invasion of Greece, which probably happens sort of towards the end of chapter 1. And then we get into chapter 2. When you'll see as we study it that there's actually a big time gap between chapter 1 and chapter 2. So chapter 2, it's time to look for a new wife. Vashti's out, and the king's servants have an idea. And I'm going to read you some of the verses from chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. But here's the idea that these guys have. They say, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa the citadel under custody of Hege, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them. And let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. And so the search begins. It's time for a new Miss Persia. In chapter 2, we meet a man. We're introduced to a man by the name of Mordecai. And the text is very particular in how it introduces him. It introduces him with these words, there was a certain Jew. The text wants to highlight for us, Mordecai is a Jewish man. And his great-grandfather was carried captive from Jerusalem into the Babylon captivity. He's a Jew. Big deal about that. And Mordecai is bringing up in his home, the text says, a lovely and beautiful young woman. She's a family member in his home, and her name is Hadassah, otherwise known as Esther. And he's bringing her up in his home because her parents are dead. And I think we should just note that this young woman has probably, I think it would be fair to assume, has probably known a bit of heartache and a bit of pain. Both of her parents are dead. And she just so happens to end up in the home of Mordecai. Esther gets chosen to be one of the contestants in the king's beauty contest. And what no one knows is that she's a Jewess. Nobody knows this. And I think it would be appropriate to mention this is quite a bit more than a beauty contest. When you're in Sunday school, it's all these beautiful young women. But the text says, after a year of beautifying, the turn came for each young woman to go in to the king. And they go in for one night to engage in physical relations. Verse 14 says, of each young woman on her appointed day, in the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the king's harem. And so Esther's turn comes. She has all this time with her cosmetics. She gets all ready, and her turn comes. And she goes in to the king, and the king delights in her and chooses to make her his next queen and seems to be head over heels for Esther. And I just want to pause and make an observation. It just so happens that the king chooses Esther. How many women are a part of this whole thing? We have no idea. Presumably hundreds. And he just so happens to pick Esther, the Jewess, out of hundreds of contestants. And then shortly thereafter, Esther's relative Mordecai is sitting at the king's gate and he hears his secret plot to assassinate the king. And so he lets the appropriate people know. He passes what he knows on to Queen Esther, who tells the king of the secret plot. And she tells the king, here's what Mordecai told me. That these guys want to take your life. And because of Mordecai's action, the two men who plotted this were hanged, and the deeds of Mordecai were recorded probably on clay or stone tablets, and they're put in the archives of the nation. But nothing is done to honor Mordecai. And I just want to pause again. It just so happens that Vashti is dethroned in a moment of drunkenness by the king. Esther, the Jewess, is chosen as queen. And it just so happens that Mordecai discovers an assassination attempt on Xerxes that the king forgets to reward him for before what happens next. chapter 3. Next, we're introduced to Haman, a man whose power and authority is second only to the king. By command of the king, everyone bowed to him when he passed, except one guy. Who is that guy? It's Mordecai. Maybe you go, why wouldn't Mordecai bow to Haman? Well, as I read through the book of Esther, I think I sure wouldn't want to bow to Haman. He's proud, he's arrogant. I don't like him. But actually, as we study this book, I think there's probably more to it than that. If you trace Mordecai's genealogy and you trace Haman's genealogy, we're told that Haman was an Agagite. He was of the descendants of Agag. You may remember where Agag shows up in the Bible, in the book of 1 Samuel, I believe. And it had to do with King Saul and a certain group of people that he was supposed to exterminate and eliminate, and he doesn't. And we're told that Mordecai is of the descendants of Kish. We have an age-old rival going on here between Mordecai and the descendants of Agag, the Jewish people and the Agagites. And Mordecai says, I am not bowing to that guy. By the way, the thing about not bowing when everybody else is bowing is you sort of stand out. Everybody's on their knees and on their face, and there you are, standing up. Everybody sees you. This is Mordecai. And obviously, this made Haman extremely angry. And so in his anger and wrath, Haman determines he's going to kill Mordecai and all of his people, the Jews. And Haman's a superstitious man. And so what he decides to do is he's going to cast lots, which were stones of some sort, and they would throw these stones on the ground, and things would be determined by the way the stones fell. So he casts lots to determine the day in which all the Jewish people will be killed. All right, I'm going to annihilate the Jewish people. Throw these stones on the ground. Okay, they tell us this date. And once a day was selected, Haman secured the king's approval to have the Jewish people wiped off the face of the globe. He goes to King Xerxes and gets him to rubber stamp it. And once the king writes an edict, it can't be revoked. And through the king's ancient pony express, the king's decree spreads like wildfire throughout the whole kingdom. All 127 provinces. And no doubt Jews are all over the place and they start to panic. But again, let's just pause. It just so happens that by casting lots, the date chosen for the extermination of the Jews is set for almost a year later. A whole year on the calendar. Chapter 4. When the news reaches Mordecai, he tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth and ashes, and sits in the middle of the city bitterly crying. And the Jews all throughout 127 provinces do something similar. They're all about to be distinguished. By the way, this is something we see several times in history. Not so far back in history, even from our modern day. And the terrible news about Mordecai and the Jewish people eventually makes it to the palace, to Esther. And the news deeply, deeply distresses her. And Mordecai and Esther end up conversing. And Mordecai instructs and begs Esther to plead with the king on behalf of her people. And you remember the famous line of Mordecai, that he basically says, perhaps God brought you to the kingdom for such a time as this. You have access to the king. You've got to do something. But there's a problem. Esther can't just go talk to the king. If you just go into the king, you could get beheaded. He's got to invite you. And to further complicate matters, it had been over a month since the last time the king summoned her. It wasn't like he had married Esther because he just, you know, this marriage was built on all these wonderful biblical principles. She basically won a contest and is now the king's trophy wife, and she hasn't seen him in a month. Is he upset? Is he done with her? I don't want to go before the king. I could lose my head. And Mordecai warns her. He says this, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. And so Esther decides, you know what? You're right. I'm going to take my chances. And she reaches the conclusion and she says these famous words, if I perish, I perish. And we get to chapter 5, and 3 days later, Esther does the unthinkable. She entered the king's throne room without an invitation. And it's no surprise, really, that the king was glad to see her. And she requests that the king and Haman join her that night for a banquet she's prepared. Now, I just want you to pause and think. If you're Esther, what would you do? Would you? I mean, if I'm Esther, I go into the king and I say, listen, there's a problem and it needs fixed now. And you just spill all the beans and you ask him to do something. But Esther's different. She's calculated. She seems to have thought this through. And she says, will you and Haman come join me for a banquet that I'm preparing? And at the banquet, she requests that they come back again the next night for another banquet. And Haman heads home that night happy as can be. And I think we see some of the wisdom of Esther here. Haman's just been invited to two different banquets. And in some ways, she's playing right to Haman's weakness. He's a man of pride. He's a man of arrogance. And he goes home as happy as he can be, feeling like he is pretty special, and he gets his wife and his family and his friends together, and he tells them all that's happened. Who else has had dinner alone with the king and his queen? But his balloon gets popped, actually, before he gets home. He heads out of the palace or wherever they're at, and his anger is aroused pretty quick when he exits and sees Mordecai at the gate not bowing to him. And he hates Mordecai. The one guy who will not acknowledge me, the one guy who won't bow to me. And when Haman gets home, he boasts to his whole family, as I just said, banquet two, banquet number one, and then a second banquet. I'm the second in all of the kingdom. The king must just absolutely be delighted in me. But he bemoans to them his predicament with Mordecai. And his family and friends suggest that he build gallows and request from the king in the morning that Mordecai be hanged. I think we should just pause again. It just so happens that Haman rushes to get his gallows built. I mean, like tonight. Get these things constructed. Tomorrow we're hanging Mordecai. And up go the gallows. It just so happens that Haman rushes to get the gallows built to hang Mordecai right after the first banquet and before the second one. And we get to chapter 6. And that night, the king has insomnia. He can't sleep. We don't know what Esther fed him, but he can't sleep. Maybe he had a bunch of caffeine. He is wide awake. So the king requests that one of his servants read to him from the chronicles of his kingdom. This should put anybody to sleep. Bring out the legal code. You can't understand it. This will put me straight to sleep. And so the servant goes and he grabs some clay tablets from the collection and begins to read. I don't know what the storage facility where all these tablets were kept was like, but I can only imagine there must have been dozens, if not hundreds, of these tablets with the chronicles of the kings. And he goes to that storage room and he goes, oh, I'll grab this one. He grabs his tablet and he goes and he reads before the king. And the next thing you know, he's not falling asleep. You would think this would put him to sleep, but he's becoming more and more awake. And this guy's reading about how Mordecai saved the king, and the king realizes that he never did anything to reward Mordecai for what he's done. What did I do for this? I didn't do anything? Oh, this is not how a king should treat those who are loyal to him. I have to do something for Mordecai. Then the king asks, who's in the court? I need an idea, guy. Who's out there? Who can we get an idea from? And would you believe it that right at that very moment, Haman walked into the court to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai. He's right there. Again, it just so happens that the king had insomnia after the banquet. He can't sleep and wants to be read to from the chronicles of the history of his kingdom. And it just so happens that the servant out of all the tablets there in the library, he grabs the one that talks about Mordecai, and he hasn't been rewarded. And it just so happens that Haman happened to be right there in the king's court. So Haman and the king are talking, and the king asks this question, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? Oh, and here Haman is. Banquet number one, banquet number two. The king loves me. I am great. And you can only imagine Haman's thinking, you must be talking about me. So he said, put the man on one of the king's royal robes. Put one of the king's royal robes on him. Put him on one of the king's horses and have one of the king's highest officials walk before him throughout the city proclaiming, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And Xerxes, the king, says, I love it. Go do that very thing exactly the way you said it for Mordecai. Don't leave a thing out. And you can imagine Haman at this moment. I guess this is not the time to bring up what I came here for. This is not good. One of the worst days in Haman's life, you would think. At that point, Haman realized, this is not good. And Haman goes home after doing all these things. He tells his friends and family all about his terrible day. And as he's doing so, the king's servants come in chapter 6, verse 14, to escort Haman to banquet number 2. And chapter 7, at the banquet, when the king inquires regarding Esther's requests, she informs the king that someone has threatened her life and the lives of her people. And she requests the king's aid, and the king asks, who is he and where is he? Who has dared to do this? And Esther replies, a foe and enemy, this wicked Haman. If he thought he was having a bad day before, now he's really, really having a bad day. And we learn from chapter 1 that this is an impulsive king and you don't want to be on his bad side. And Haman is terrified and the king is so furious that he gets up from this meal and he goes straight out into his garden. Maybe he's just saying, I got to cool off and I got to think, I can't believe this, and he's mad as can be. And in those days, they used to recline on couches as they ate. And when the king returns, he's gone out to the garden, and now he's coming back in. He finds Haman falling down at Esther's couch, pleading for mercy. I mean, if you imagine Haman, he realizes this is not pretty. He throws himself at Esther's feet and is begging for mercy. Enters king. Here he comes. And what happens is the king totally misinterprets what's going on. It just so happens that the king mistakes Haman's pleading for mercy as an attempt to violate the queen. And if he was mad before, he's even more mad now. And at this point, the king is absolutely irate. And ironically, one of these servants mentions the gallows Haman built for Mordecai. Oh, he was building these gallows for Mordecai. And they take the enemy of the Jews, that's how he's referred to in the book of Esther, and they take him out, and they hang him, and they kill him. Then we get to chapter 8. And next thing you know, Mordecai has Haman's house. He has his car. He's got it all. He has his signet, the king's signet ring. And all of this honor that Haman seems to have has all been given to Mordecai. And Esther implores the king to reverse the edict to annihilate the Jews. And it can't be done. What the king has written, the king has written. The king says, why I can't change this law? He allows Esther and Mordecai to write another decree, essentially canceling the first one. And as a result, I'll just read a verse or two to you here. It says, the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods. And so this decree goes out again. All 127 provinces of the king. And now the Jews are rejoicing. We get to chapter 9, and there is just a great, great slaughter when this day comes. By the time it was all said and done, over 75,000 enemies of the Jews had been killed throughout the king's provinces. We thought on this day all the Jews were going to be wiped off of the face of the earth. And the exact opposite has happened. The tables have churned, and all the Jews are rejoicing. And from that point on, a feast and a holiday is instituted called Purim to commemorate the events that have just taken place. And Esther and Mordecai basically say this new holiday will be celebrated by the Jews from here on out through the rest of time. And in chapter 10, we're told of the greatness of Mordecai. Now, we've gone through the whole story. We've seen what's happened. We've seen the resolution, the crisis, the reversal. And you may be aware of this fact, but did you know that God is never once mentioned in the book of Esther? You read through all 10 chapters, and you'll never once find the name of God. Not one time. But God is everywhere throughout the book of Esther. Every time you turn around, you see the hand of God at work in the details and the minutiae of the story. And I tried as we went through this story to just point some of those out. You have the removal of Vashti as queen. And a moment of stupidness and drunkenness and folly. You have the selection of Esther as the next queen. And nobody knows she's a Jewish. You have a young woman whose parents have died. A tragic occurrence. She's known pain, she's known heartache, and she just so happens to be in the home of Mordecai. It just so happens that Haman throws these stones on the ground, and a whole year later, the date is set to exterminate the Jews. It just so happens the king can't sleep. It just so happens that the servant goes and grabs the one particular tablet that talks about what Mordecai has done. It just so happens that the king walks back into that second banquet and he sees Mordecai and he misinterprets the situation and Mordecai is killed, or Haman is killed. And I think there's a lesson for us about the big picture of the book of Esther. God is always at work behind the scene bringing about his purposes. God operates in such a way that he is usually silent, but he's always there. I think in the Christian life, we sometimes get really, really frustrated because we go, where is God? Why is this happening and why is that happening? And what's up with this over here? God, where are you? And why don't you just say something? Why don't you do some sort of miracle? Or why don't you, I'm going to throw this fleece out. Why don't you do something special with it and just remind me that you're in charge? And yet God doesn't seem to do that. In fact, God doesn't generally operate by miracles. I mean, if you study your Bible, we read a lot about those, but they actually only happened at 3 points, really, in biblical history. There's only a small amount of time where God's really doing these big, dramatic miracles. God doesn't generally operate by miracles, but through trivialities. And as you go through life and you face challenges and difficulties and uncertainties, you might even wonder, where is God? Is God here? And the reality is God is always here. As we jump into this book, what you're going to realize, there's a lot of sin going on in this book. I mean, the fact that Esther and Mordecai are even in Persia is a very questionable thing. Why are they in Persia? Where are the rest of their people? How did they get to Persia? Well, they ended up in Persia because the Babylonian captivity happened. Nebuchadnezzar comes and he takes the land, he takes Jerusalem, he destroys the city, and people are exported out of Jerusalem, and they end up in Babylon for 70 years. And after that 70 years is up, the Jews start to go back. They go back to the land. Why are Esther and Mordecai still in Persia? Are they in the center of God's will for their life? Maybe, maybe not. We look at what happens with Esther and this whole beauty contest and you go, that doesn't seem right. That makes me feel uncomfortable. And there's messiness all over this story and God is never mentioned, and yet behind the scenes, God is bringing about his plan. Psalm 75 verse 1 says, "We give thanks to you, O God, we give thanks for your wondrous works declare that your name is near." God's wondrous works declare that he is near. If I was going to state a theme for the book of Esther, this is a little bit long, I know, but here's what I would say. Behind the scenes in providence, God constantly reigns as the sovereign king of the universe and constantly cares for the needs of his people, giving them constant cause for celebration. God is present and active in our lives all the time. And we looked at providence, the big picture. We saw that God preserves all that he brings into existence, and then he governs his universe. He brings his eternal plans into the realm of time. The book of Esther points us to the King of Kings and anticipates his eternal rule. I'd encourage you to read the book of Esther and ask this question. Who's the main character in the book of Esther? Who is it? Well, we know that God's not mentioned, but obviously somehow he is the main character, right? But from a human perspective, who's the main character? And if you look at the book just by who's mentioned the most, you might be surprised. Because the person that's mentioned the most, the person that shows up again and again and again in the book of Esther, is not Esther. There's chapters where Esther isn't even mentioned. It's not Mordecai. It's not Haman. So, I've ruled out all the characters. You can probably guess who it is. But there is a person who's mentioned again and again and again and again. On every page, almost every sentence, this person's mentioned. And I think this person is mentioned to remind us, as you look at him, that somebody else is actually in charge. Just by numbers alone, the king is mentioned more than anybody else in the book of Esther. And I think as we look at this king, we're reminded that behind this earthly king, there's another king, bringing about his plans through all of this human mess. And that gives us great, great cause for celebration. I'm looking forward to our study of the book of Esther together, and I'm excited about what God has in store.